guys, I'm Adam Rapport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, before we get started on this week's show, I want to put another call out for emails. Next week, Carla Music, our buddy Gabe T, and I are recording our peak summer cooking podcast, and we want questions from you. It could be about, I don't know, grilling, like how do you grill a whole fish and not have it stick to the grills? Could be, are those $5 a pound heirloom tomatoes at the green market actually worth it? Hit us with any and all of your summer cooking, grilling, entertaining questions. And now, this week, we have on Riad Nasser and Lee Hansen, chef owners of Frenchette here in New York City, winner of the James Beard Foundation's Best New Restaurant in America. After cooking together for decades at Balthazar and Pastis and Minetta Tavern here in New York, Riad and Lee decided that it was finally time to open their own restaurant. However, it took them literally 6 years to do so. I talked to them about how and why that happened, what it was like to go from managing kitchens to owning your own business, and how they got Frenchette to be such a cool, buzzy, fun restaurant. All right, let's do this. I feel getting this podcast going has been as difficult as you guys opening Frenchette.
I don't know what you've suffered through. Exactly. Has it taken 6 years?
It did take 6 years, but it took a long time to get you guys through security and then finding the right floor. And then all the headphones were tangled up. The mics didn't work. Emma didn't realize you had to plug in the headphones for them to work. High roll over there.
Yeah. It was a little Freudian going up and down and through the tunnel.
But we got here. And you're on after all these years, finally. Wow. Yeah. So I've realized I've known both of you guys for a long time through that kind of semi-professional circles of like writing about restaurants and whatnot. But then I also realized that I was eating your food long before I knew you, when I certainly had gone to Danielle, Restaurant Danielle uptown many times back in the day. And I was like, okay, I guess I was eating your food then also. Is that where you guys met, or where did you first come together?
It was the first date, Lee. Do you remember?
Well, you guys really are like an old Jewish couple.
So much nicer when he tells it.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay. So we did meet at Danielle, and that was the year April 93. Mm-hmm. And Danielle just opened his own place. He left Le Cirque to do his own restaurant. So this is actually the old Cafe Balloud space.
So you're on 76th Street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was the first Danielle, and then he moved uptown lower after that. But yes, we met April opening, so craziness.
So how old are you guys at that point?
We were 25 years younger, right?
You got like the smooth jazz voice going, Lee.
I'm really thinking about making a jump to radio.
I think easy listening.
You got a little Howard Stern thing going.
Yeah,
I gotta say.
Yes, I'm the loud, pushy Jewish guy. Was one of you like higher up the chain at the point when you met?
He was a sous chef. I was brought in as saucier.
Oh, saucier.
Yeah, saucier. Yeah.
So if you're the saucier at a restaurant like Danielle, is your job literally just to make the sauce every day?
Sauce and cooking and grilling, or cooking all the meats.
Oh, okay.
And doing all the sauces. It's basically, the meat. You're in charge of all the
meats.
Remember
about hitting the table. No hitting the table.
Sorry.
So there you've got like the baby lamb, and you've got the tenderloin of beef with the red wine sauce. Are you like starting every day by making the veal stock and stuff, or like who's literally doing that sort of thing?
Day crew would do stocks and base jus.
What's a base jus?
Like a veal jus, a chicken jus, roasted chicken jus, duck jus, game jus, just all the basics.
All the basics if you work at a fancy French restaurant.
Your building block to build a sauce afterwards. We didn't really have a butcher there. We had a butcher who would sort of break things down primally, but didn't do any portioning and sort of some of the fine stuff. So I would do that. And
what time did you get to work?
I mean, I used to get in there a little bit later than most. That's my crazy lifestyle.
What does that mean?
People were getting in there like at 10 o'clock in the morning to be ready for 6 o'clock.
Oh, for 6 o'clock dinner. That's crazy. And you guys weren't doing lunch
Were we salary? We were salary sort of there, right? We were not paid by the hour. We were paid by salary. It was against labor laws at the time, I think.
Right, we're salary.
This is not like in France where you work a 35-hour work week and you go home.
No, we were working easily 80 hours a week, I'm sure. Wow. Pretty much that.
And, how many days a week?
We were six days at that time.
Yeah.
So you only closed Sunday, so it was 6 days.
Coming in, you were butchering some primal cuts.
Breaking things down, getting that station ready. Lee was sous chef, and I kind of sous chef in charge of fish side, mostly, right?
So mm-hmm. sous chef at that point, at a restaurant like Danielle, you've got Danielle himself, who's still very much in the game at that point, in the kitchen, yeah. yelling at everybody.
Sure.
Then below him was who?
Alex Lee.
Oh, Alex
chef
Lee.
Chef de cuisine.
All right, so then it's him, Danielle, him, you next?
Yeah. Then me and Philippe Bertineau were.
Oh, Philippe Bertineau. So this has been sort of mentioned before, but I feel it's interesting whether you're in media or in restaurants, there are those moments when something starts, and being part of that moment, whether it's a new publication, a music scene in a certain city, whether it's Seattle in the 90s or New York in the early 70s, mid-70s. At Danielle, there was a lot of chefs who worked there who went on to pretty prominent things. You guys, Chang, Philippe, Al, I mean, like, did you at the time recognize that this was a pretty talented group of people you were working with?
Oh, definitely. I think, all the big chefs kind of attract those. They're like hubs of various chefs who come in and go out. Danielle was definitely one of those. Yeah, even the cooks. A lot of the cooks we work with. Michael Anthony was a cook when we were there. Jonathan Bennett was a cook when we were there.
Michael Anthony's now with that Untitled, Gramercy Taffer, all that sort of stuff, and Benno with his restaurants.
Right.
Was it competitive among you guys on that lower rung? Or were you just trying to survive with Danielle?
Exactly. It was all like, you're in a boat going onto the shores of
Normandy.
So you're paired off and trying to keep everybody afloat.
All right, Riyadh, what is the most pissed off Danielle ever got at you?
We had a pretty good relationship. I mean, I could kind of get pissed off too. I think the French helped with that. The most pissed off, there was just once where, he kind of just put me in my place early on, and he didn't really need to do it after that.
How did he put you in your place?
I mean, it was an overcooked duck, or overcooked according to maybe him or the customer. I think it was pretty spot on, according to me. And it came back, and he just got in my face and just dressed me down, like, pretty brutally.
In front of everybody.
I was a worm, I'm still a worm. He made his point. At that point, I was probably feeling a little bit big for my britches. I'm a little loudmouth sometimes, and he put me down. That was his moment to say, this is my kitchen, not yours, okay? And this is my duck, not your duck.
So it's interesting. That was a long time ago, 25 years ago, and obviously kitchen culture has changed a lot over the last 25 years. Certainly, I would think over the last 2 years with all that's going on in restaurants. With you guys coming from that world, but now being in this day and age, how do you run a restaurant like Frenchette, given how you grew up and what the restaurant industry is like now?
We still have that. We still have a pretty traditional brigade system,
which means what exactly?
Which means you have. Well, we don't have a chef de partie and commis, but we have, stations that are still pretty traditional. We have an entremets station, which is vegetable focused, and maybe hot appetizers. We have a grill station. We have a roast station. We have a fish station. We have garde-manger. And we kind of have the same sort of breakdown in terms of sous chefs that Danielle. Like, we took that model, basically, that, we were brought up in and have been sort of following that playbook since.
But you also have an open kitchen at Frenchette. And as diligently as you guys work, and anyone who's been there can just look in, they see both of you with your heads down, typically, I don't hear you guys yelling at anybody.
There's a sound barrier there. There's some yelling going on. I mean, that's the thing. I think your first question was kind of alluding to that, like, as the kind of dress downs and the screaming at people, perhaps physical intimidation has gone down over the years. Definitely, for sure. But there's a way of being, we're very focused at what we do, and we want everyone to be on their game and to keep everybody at that without being, a dick about it.
It's like, I mean,
and respecting people. Sometimes you do have to yell at and raise your voice. That's the only way to get things across.
Well, it's loud to begin with. The kitchens are loud, so you're calling out orders loud. You're battling a makeup air and an exhaust system and pots and pans and all that kind of stuff. So it's loud to begin with. So you kind of have to, over the din, which is loud, kind of project. So that is already kind of intimidating. I mean, I think the difference is there's no harboring of anything. And if there is some words exchanged. There's usually a makeup. Mm-hmm. There's very definitely a makeup. You know, I mean, Lee and I both say hello to your cooks. You say goodbye to your cooks. You say thank you for your thing. You have a moment there. And if somebody had a particularly bad day, when it kind of calms down a little bit, you gotta sort of explain what you wanted or why it went down or why it went south and kind of. You know, build them up a little bit.
I think what's unique about restaurants is that, you know, in just comparing it to magazines, at least when our business was making a magazine once a month, and there was the week that we would ship the magazine, and that things would get a little crispy and a little intense in that week. And there was a few days where everything would kind of come to a head and frustrations would boil over and tempers would get lost. But I do think, to your point, like I've been that person several times before. Like I've sent an email afterwards, like, you know what, sorry about that. I shouldn't have. You recognize that I think we sort of lose our temper, but then you've got to sort of like, that's not a way to sort of run a business and we're all in this together.
No, yeah, you have to acknowledge your mistakes as well. And, you know, I make them. We all make them. But you have to also, you can't lose sight of the humanity.
Yeah.
You know,
you're in it together. I always say you spend a lot more time with your coworkers than you do with your spouse and children.
Well, absolutely. The other thing is, you know, we've gotten a little older. So, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot older. 25
years older.
So you can roll off a little bit easier. And you've kind of been there. You can see when someone is kind of about to lose it, and screaming is not going to help.
Yeah.
You know, it's the exact opposite. You want to slow things down.
Okay. So did Danielle, and kind of that was sort of the most high profile, high-end restaurant in the city at the time. You then segued to Balthazar, which opened in 97? Down in Soho, Keith McNally, and that was, I would say, was and still is the most glamorous, bustling, energetic restaurants the city's ever seen. What was fascinating about Balthazar, and Keith has talked a lot about this, like, the restaurant was famous, the chefs weren't. It wasn't a celebrity chef restaurant. And it seemed like Keith was pretty adamant about that. Did you guys realize that going in? Was that something you were okay with? Or were you like, yeah, we'll let the restaurant be the star and we're the guys running the kitchen?
I think we were fine with that. We understood the concept of the restaurant, and we were trying to create a timeless place and put a menu together that would be also timeless and classic and just, you know, live a long, long, healthy life. So we didn't really need to sort of impose chefy things, you know. We needed to run a tight ship.
But that was at odds. This is so late 90s when the whole celebrity chef thing is really taking off. Like the Food Network at that point was it had lift off. And like the Bobby Flays of the world, that's like when they were really coming into their own. And that's what was interesting with you guys. It's like, oh, here you are in the most high profile, sort of the place to be, but yet you were both very under the radar. And it seemed like you guys were okay with that. I didn't know you well back then at all. I have no idea.
I mean, also we're doing 1,000 covers a day. We didn't have time to really think about anything else but making sure the fries were crispy. You
know? I mean, and literally, when you say 1,000 covers a day, that's not an exaggeration, right?
No.
I mean, that's like Tavern on the Green numbers
exactly,
back in the day.
Yeah. But we were never, I don't know if this celebrity chef, if their personality, I don't know if that was ever us to begin with. Even with Frenchette, I don't see us being these kind of those types of chefs. We always kind of just like being in the kitchen. That was where we were most comfortable and working with everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, you both have the smooth jazz soft voice, I hear.
Right.
Yeah, you're not outlandish, over-the-top personality chefs, whereas like some of those guys come along who are like, do you even have a restaurant anymore, or are you just doing like shows and cookbooks and you're a quote-unquote chef?
Yeah, I think we both like slogging it out, and that was the thing, and sort of leading from that example. With our crews. So
what was that like about there? So it opens, it has just a tidal wave of press. Everyone from Anna Wintour to Madonna to you name it is there on a seemingly daily basis. At first, when it opened, breakfast was just kind of pastries and stuff. You eventually did full breakfast. But from noon to, I imagine, 2 a.m., it seems like it was always full. And there was never a break.
No.
What was that like? I don't understand. Like, how do you put? It feels like you're playing. You're like a football player, like just putting your body through that daily punishment. I mean, what was that grind like? What was it like?
Oh, for sure, it's excruciating. But you know, there's also a level of, you know, the restaurant business is kind of like a drug, and certain personalities like ourselves need that kind of energy to feel productive and feel good about ourselves. And so that energy feels great to run around and go up and down the stairs and just be in that hectic environment. And
I imagine it's pretty consuming, and that becomes your life.
It does, yes.
Yeah. You're out of balance. You're totally out of balance. Okay, we maybe not, you know, alcoholics or drug users. I don't think we could and still, you know, function in that restaurant. It was kind of that busy. But I think, personalized, you know, it takes a toll on your family life. You know, me physically, I had double knee replacement, you know,
really? When did that
2
happen?
Years ago.
I remember that. Wow.
Yeah, which was nuts. Or partial anyway. I mean, I know it wasn't only that, but yeah, there was a set of stairs there at Balthazar, and I was up and down those stairs I don't know how many times a day. Think about it.
And once everything is up and running at Balthazar, what was your schedule like? When would you get there? When would you work till?
Well, you know, a year in or 2 years in, we opened Pastis.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I remember that in 99.
And that, you know, was good, totally manageable, until something happened in the meatpacking district that just the switch went off, and that restaurant went from kind of like really kind of like on the edge of town to in the middle of town.
People aren't in New York. The meatpacking district is just like this like nightlife scene now, but at the time there were actually still meatpacking plants there. You were on the edge of town, warehouses
for sure.
And I remember when Keith opened Pastis, across the street was that little bar, Rio Mar, great little Spanish restaurant. Yeah. And there was Florent, the old sort of hipster 24-hour diner. And there was nothing else there.
No.
Like, literally nothing else.
No.
And now it's like you're on the Strip in Vegas. Yeah. It's crazy. And then the Gansevoort Hotel opened across the street, and that kind of changed the complexion of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so I imagine you were doing probably how many covers a day there?
Oh, it was insane. I mean, insane. With a patio outside, 1,500 covers a day at least. I don't know. Something like that. Crazy numbers.
It's had to.
And everything done by hand,
the outside.
Right? Yeah.
And how much of a staff at each place were you managing?
Monsters. Probably 70, 60 in the kitchen.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, I'm exhausted just talking to you guys. And so we got Pastis, we got Balthazar, then Shoulders Liquor Bar open, and then Minetta Tavern opened in the late 2000s. Yeah. And at that point, when you guys migrated over to Minetta, did you have to stop worrying about Balthazar and Pastis? Was that all sort of off your plate?
No, we still had to oversee. I mean, we oversaw all. We had CDCs installed. Chef de Cuisines at each of the stores. But we would kind of rotate. We'd do like, I guess at that point, Minetta maybe became a home base where
Balthazar was prior.
Prior.
Yeah.
And we would split it up. It'd be like 1 week where Lee would be at Pastis and I would be at Balthazar, and maybe he would travel between Pastis and Schiller's. And we just rotate. But we would try and stay consistently at one.
Okay. And Minetta was obviously a smaller restaurant,
yeah,
a little bit more exclusive. Black Label Burger got famous for.
Yeah.
But then how did you guys, and as we sort of get to Frenchette, where you were there together, cooking in the kitchen together, and I know you get this sort of question asked a lot, but that many years in, did you need your space from each other?
It kind of naturally happened because we had to be in different restaurants all the time.
Yeah.
Because we were separate to oversee four restaurants, we didn't spend a lot of overlapping time together.
Yeah.
Once this goes, I mean, once you open one there, you're together for 6 months because you have to get, that's how long it takes to get a place going.
At least.
All right, so I'm going to fast forward here a bit. You guys eventually decided to go solo, and this was about 6 years ago. Okay, so what the hell took so long? Like, how is it really that hard to open a restaurant in New York?
The 5 year gap, or
yeah,
or,
the 5 year gap, like it should not take 5 years.
Or slogging it out for 16 years and then deciding making
well,
that
then
decision.
Decided to stay married and like open a restaurant together. Like, I think the natural thing at that point, like Kevin Durant or whomever, you're like, all right, I did this, I proved I could do this with this, and now I'm going to go my own way and do my own thing. Why? So whose decision was it? Like, was that even a decision, or did you know you were going to stay together?
Well, we signed a contract when we first met 25 years ago. That we,
in blood. In
and we still have
blood.
Another 10 to go on that. So, No, I mean, we did have a couple of years where we had a stalled project, and then...
But let's get back to the let's. When you decided to leave Minetta, and we don't have to get into that whole sort of thing, but was it just a given that you were going to stick together as a team?
That's all we knew.
Yeah, that, you know... you know, we started cooking together to do a restaurant together. And yeah, we opened, you know, Balthazar, and we did some great, incredible restaurants, and we did them together, but it still wasn't our restaurant.
Yeah. You were not owners. Did you have a piece of Minetta?
Yes, we did.
Yeah. Did you try to buy Minetta when you guys got out?
We took a swing.
We took a swing.
We took a pretty feeble swing. Yeah, you know.
Keith was like, "I'm good. I'll keep this."
He's good. Pretty much. You know. We didn't. That was the whole. You talk about that 5-year gap in between. It's a whole education, really. You know, breaking up, amicable or not, is hard to do.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun. It's.
You mean you guys with Keith, or you guys with each other?
With Keith, just even trying to sort it out, just to try and keep, you know, everything sort of intact.
So you guys had to deal with, like, getting bought out from him, essentially?
Kind of, yeah.
But, yeah, you were deciding to leave on your own, and so that was complicated.
Yeah.
Lawyers, I imagine?
Yeah, it was, you know, litigious in the sense that, you know, there are contracts or lack of contracts, really, that, you know, we needed to sort of understand and work through. I'm trying to be really cool. it was a learning experience, and I'm sure it was a learning experience for him as well, you know. He had 16 years of, you know, two sort of rock-solid employees or partners to a degree. And you know, the time had come for us to sort of move on. We saw that, you know, the company as it was growing wasn't growing in a direction perhaps that we wanted to grow in. You know, we still needed, you know, personal fulfillment, and we wanted to call all the shots. We wanted to do a place.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
So you decided, like, we're going to do this together.
Yep.
The first word I heard from you guys was 4 years ago or something. You're like, yeah, we're going to open at the Don Quixote space in the Chelsea Hotel, which is this amazing old school Spanish restaurant with the beautiful neon sign out front and the historic Chelsea Hotel where every bohemian and poet and everybody's been.
Yeah.
What the hell happened there?
Yeah, lots happened there. That's
it's still not open. So you can
imagine. The hotel is still not, that whole hotel project.
It's a mess.
And the character who's trying to, so that was that a lot of lawyers and stuff going on? Short of that.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah.
We left Keith without a really strong exit strategy, so we took a bit of time to sort of look for spaces.
You know, I always tell people, don't leave a job until you know you have another one.
Yeah, that's great advice.
But you didn't follow that.
Certainly not. No, we didn't have money. We didn't have any of that, you know, or backing, you know, or any of that stuff. So you need to be sort of a little bit better prepared.
So eventually you got some sort of an equivalent of a severance from Keith in terms of whatever that buyout was.
Yeah.
So that could sort of carry you for a little bit.
Float.
But does that float you for 5 years, though?
No, it certainly doesn't. And we found Chelsea, and that was supposed to be a 2-year project. We actually probably shelved a project that we thought we were going to get.
That space would have been amazing.
Which one? The one that we shelved?
No, Don Quixote.
Yeah.
El Quixote. Anyways, amazing bar. Long, beautiful bar.
Incredible.
Different rooms, oil paintings.
Incredible. A slice of New York that, you know, that it's the kind of thing that you crave.
And you would have had to do very little to it other than just give it a clean up and all that sort of stuff. Put
a
new kitchen. New kitchen.
Yeah.
Equipment.
Yeah.
So you stuck with it for that long, thinking that we'll work this out?
Well,
at what point did you realize this is not going to work out?
El Quixote turned into the entire F&B for the entire Chelsea Hotel project. So it turned into not just that restaurant. It turned into a rooftop. It turned into another concepted restaurant that we were working on. It turned into
lobby bars, everything.
It turned into a big, big thing.
Which is a thing now, like, you know, you see the guys, you know, like at the Nomad Group with like Dan or Will and stuff, and they just opened the Nomad Hotel in Vegas, and they're doing, from soup to nuts, it becomes big business, big potential money, if you do it right.
Yeah.
So we spent 2 years designing all that
concepting
stuff.
Concepting it.
Literally. The back of the house, the basement, the kitchens, everything. Yeah.
And names, concepts, menus, and all
Not
that
so
sort
much
of stuff,
names, but
what each would be and how it would operate. And then at what point did you know you needed to pull the ripcord?
It just seemed like delays were not going anywhere. They weren't being cleared up, so changes were being made. There was some infighting, and then we're...
Definitely.
It's like, this is going to take a while. We have to get out.
Yeah, they were stalled, and I think we...
Were you on retainer at that point? Were you guys getting paid anything?
Development fee. Yeah.
And was that a one-off thing, or was it like a monthly sort of
thing? It was kind of monthly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not really enough, but, you know, it's... You know, as their delays grew, you know, it's just... within the contract, there are, you know, there's a certain sort of payback to the amount of development fee that you can take. And then one of the partners had a great idea too. Well, you guys are sitting on the sideline. Let's just open a restaurant, and that wasn't so cool with the other partners. Okay, so that sort of erupted, and you know, there
so that ended further that for you.
Further segmented there, or further fractured what was going on there.
Now, was that restaurant, did that become Frenchette, or is that a different project?
That became a nothing. We were looking at spaces, Jesus. And then we realized, okay, then we sort of got stuck. The way the deal was structured, you're kind of there were non-competes, but. They sort of leverage a little bit the non-competes against breaking our contract, so to speak.
So you're 4 years post Minetta. At this point, are you like, what the hell are we doing with ourselves? Like, are we cursed? Like, what were you just like, we just need to leave New York? Or what was going through your mind at that point? What were your sort of options?
Once we broke free of Chelsea, which was, I think, in the spring of 15 or 16.
So it took a year to...
16.
It took a year to break up.
We pretty much found Frenchette, which was the old Circle Rouge space, probably 2 months later. So we kind of went right into it.
Right into
it. Yeah. And then the negotiation of the space took a few months.
Did you have to find investor partners,
yeah.
or did you already
no,
have
No, we had
ones?
To do that. Yeah.
So you had to go and find guys like, hey. Yeah. All right, so let's talk about that. So you find the space. It's in Tribeca, just south of the canal. Was an old French bistro. You guys zhuzhed it up. Beautiful lighting, beautiful layout. A lot of beautiful woodwork. I don't know anything about woodwork, but I love the wood there. So how much does that cost? Are you spending like $1 million to open a restaurant? Like $5 million? It was not $5 million. How is that possible?
Yeah.
You're just like every... So just the whole...
That's what it costs to open a restaurant out. From scratch like that. Especially we had to dig the basement out.
Really?
Because the basement wasn't high enough to have a hood, so we had to go down 2 feet. That particular area of Tribeca, the water table is 2 feet below that, so there's all kinds of engineering shit you got to do, and it's just it just adds up. Plus, it took a year and a half to build.
And at that point, no one's making money.
Right?
No one's
making money. Over budget. You know, sometimes you go over budget for reasons you can't control. And then there's sometimes you're like, well, do we prefer the zinc bar made, you know, in one piece, preferred to a wood, you know, bar top that's cheaper, but. You're like, well, aesthetically, we have to go with the more expensive one. So you kind of
make I would say one thing coming from your McNally days, that's one thing I think everyone always appreciated, whether they knew it or not, about Balthazar and Pessy. It's like, oh, those are actually hand-tiled mosaic floors. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a zinc bar that was brought in from mm-hmm. Paris. And mm-hmm. it's like, it feels real because it is real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you just intuitively know that as a customer.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So at that point, you're like, okay, we're a year and a half over. We're insane budget. And then you're also paying rent at this point.
Yes.
We were paying rent pretty...
We paid half rent for a while, but then...
We had 6 months?
6 months, half, so you basically had...
And rent these days is what, like $80,000 a month or something?
It's not that bad, no. but it's...
You're paying $60,000 a month in rent.
A little better than that.
A little better. All right. 50. $40,000.
A little better.
Really? I thought...
I think we got
a good deal.
No, I think we got a fair deal. I think it was an upgrade over his previous tenant.
Okay.
You know, we'd actually kicked the tires on that space when we first left Balthazar. Hmm. We knew it was underperforming and yeah. had an idea that something cool could happen there. But so I think we negotiated a proper deal. I think it's worth it. He's happy. We're happy.
Yeah. How many years is the lease?
15 plus 15. 5.
Okay.
Yeah. So we were going to build with the intention of permanence. You know, it'll probably outlast at least me.
Yeah. At least your knees. You got a hip replacement.
Leah's spry. I'm less than spry.
So, but the challenge is, anytime you start a business, the more money you need to get it up and running, the more investment you need to take on. But the more investment take on, the less you own of it. Is that correct to say?
I think we structured our deal. First of all, we did it kind of old school. I mean, we didn't have a big whale. You know, we didn't really mm-hmm. have any investors in our pocket. We had friends and, you know, family that, you know, believed in the project or believed in us. So
yeah, but does family know a restaurant costs $5 million?
Well, no, well, yeah,
like,
sure. Well,
maybe, yes, I can maybe give not you $10,000.
It's five when you kind of keep adding everything that you're still paying for.
What's the wood called? I think I looked up one, like Sidel or something.
Sapele, which is cheaper than mahogany.
Cheaper than mahogany.
it's
but it looks
just it looks fancier.
All right, so you finally get through it all. you're like, wow, we just dropped $5 million, paying all this rent. Like, now we got to hire a staff, but people wanted to come work for you because they know you guys. You've been around for a long time. It seemed like an interesting project, cool name. And they, so you hired your crew, you know?
Yeah.
We hired a crew, some of them pretty early.
So yeah. Did you have to keep them on retainer until the place opened?
Yeah, of course.
We did. Because you're like, oh, we'll be open by July, but then July becomes...
We hired our general manager in August. We didn't open until the following April.
See, that's crazy.
But yeah. We thought we would open in the fall, and everything gets pushed back. So,
There was work to be done, but you know, it's, you have somebody leave a key position for a key position. You know, if you want to keep them, you think you have to do the right thing. So people were really good. You know, it wasn't necessarily full salary. You know, everybody suffered.
Yeah.
You know, financially, to get the place open.
Any other knee replacements among the group, or are you the only one?
I think no.
just Riyadh.
It was just me.
Okay, but then what's insane about restaurants is you don't get rewarded for effort. Well, in a sense you do. There's no guarantee for effort. You could have gone through all this. You could have dropped $5 million, spent 2 years opening it, hiring all the staff, put it on retainer, working your tails off, opening it. Bad review from Pete Wells in the New York Times, and all of a sudden you're closed within a year, and none of that money comes back.
None of it.
And and all the beautiful Cipelli wood. Mm-hmm. It's like, yep, nope, don't get that. We can't sell that.
Yeah.
It's like, but that's insane about restaurants. Like, there's some very nice restaurants that have opened over the years. Yeah. Literally a year in, just pulled the plug on, and everything's done.
Yeah. There's definitely a tremendous appreciation to anybody opening a place. You know, when you go through it, you have to, you know, just hats off to anybody, anything. You know, at whatever level, it's everybody's experiencing exactly that, you know.
Yeah, and so, and obviously you appreciated the intensity and what was at stake. And I remember going there a few times early on, and I wrote about this in my editor's letter. I just immediately, I love this place. Great energy, vibe. It just felt like what a New York restaurant should be. Great wine, great food. But it looked, especially until Pete Wells reviewed the restaurant in Times, didn't seem like you guys were interested in chatting and hanging out and
still not
gallivanting around the dining room. You were like, I am working. I mean, how many days straight did you work until that review came out?
4 months straight.
Yeah, it was
four months straight without a day off.
Yeah, we were through the review phase.
And literally every
And pretty much after for a bit. And a lot of people work long hours. Yeah. We did not take a day, no, because we had to be there.
Was that discussed or was that just assumed?
No.
Just assumed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We did the same thing with Minetta and other restaurants. You just stay there until, because you never know when a critic's going to come in with the aliases. Yeah.
And Riyadh wasn't going, hey, Lee, do you mind if I go fly fishing this Saturday?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. Only in his dreams.
It canceled a pretty spectacular trip. It didn't line up. But he also, critic is one thing. You know, it's health department is another thing. It's you're still building the restaurant and we had to be there.
So, and a lot of media, food industry types were coming because knowing your work from your previous restaurants, when Pete came in for the first time, I assume you knew he was there in these days. Like, doesn't purport to be an anonymous guy anymore. He's not making a reservation under his name, but you kind of, if you work, you know who he is.
You can ID him, yeah.
You can ID him. There are enough pros that have served him before that, you know, the minute he walked in.
Do you remember what he ordered the first time?
We have the copies of the the orders.
Really?
He did the full run of amuse. He had sweetbreads that first time. He had a couple other things. First order I thought was probably I don't want to say the best order, but it was probably the most adventurous. And then he did another visit where it was just dishes for two. So they were four people. They each had a dish for two. So it was kind of fun.
And when you were sending the food out, were you like, there's that feeling like sometimes when you take a test in high school,
I think it sucked.
And you're like, oh, you did? Because like, there are certain times where you're like, you know what? I nailed that. I know I got like a 93 on that. Like, I'm not even worried. Or were you just like,
I think he's got to know at this point that it's never as good as just a regular customer. It's
really
not. You fuss too much. Oh. You just fuss too much.
Interesting.
You fuss. You watch this thing kind of like cook and get beautiful, and then you just fuss with it a little too much, and then watch it go horrible.
Lee, do you agree?
Just go right
to
off.
A certain extent, yes. It doesn't go horrible, but
well, plus the insight. between the two of us.
We have so much self. I mean, you have self-doubt. You're like, oh, that must. You always think the worst.
That's it.
Sometimes. There's the occasional, like, okay, that's a good one.
I just don't think it's as natural a process. Cooked. Right? It's not. It doesn't.
Yeah, you obsess. You obsess too much. You overthink things. Overthink it. And yeah, we've all been there in one respect or another in our life.
The timing isn't quite as perfect. And in some ways, you know, just.
It's the same thing. Like, you're big into music and stuff. It's like, it's being in the studio and obsessing over things instead of just, like, jamming and being in a groove.
Yeah, you think you stink. That's what they say, right?
So review comes out, very positive review.
Yeah.
What was that night like?
It's pretty good. I think there's a great picture of Lee taking a nap. He's right next to me on we're sitting on a banquette, and I think I'm looking at my phone and some text messages, and he just like
out cold. Okay, so couple questions about the rest before we get to lightning round. We're doing lightning round. Are we doing it right on time, Emma? She's giving me the like, keep it moving. Have you got the soundproofing in yet?
Soon.
Explain that, right? I love a loud restaurant, but your restaurant you've heard this from everyone. Like, it can get very loud in the dining room.
It's ridiculously loud, yeah.
So how much does it cost? What does it take to just put in some panels like on the ceiling and a few under the tables? I would assume it's not that hard, but maybe it is that hard.
There's some logistics involved. You know, we don't want to close. All the fixtures on the roof have to come down.
What do you mean?
I mean, on the ceiling.
Uh-huh. We could do stuff like that and just stick them up there.
Like the panels.
We want to do something a little nicer, so it takes a little more organization and money to do that properly.
Yeah. I know.
Emma, have you been to French yet?
No. Also depends
it's really
on the crowd.
Loud. Bring these headphones.
Also, the booths you have, one thing is nice is they're large tables, so you're not like cramped on the tables.
So you gotta yell.
But the other thing is the person opposite you is kind of far away.
Yeah.
And so it all just sort of builds.
That's a total misstep. I think we should have, you know, had a little bit more foresight, put some acoustical plastering in before we built it. You know, I don't think we cut that necessarily from the budget, but I think
we spent more time insulating for the neighbors upstairs.
Yeah.
That's thoughtful of you.
No, that also had an effect because they're so well insulated above us. The sound is absolutely trapped where it is.
That makes sense.
You know, so there are a couple.
But that's what's fascinating about a restaurant is that you learn so much and you don't know until the place is actually up and running and full of people and people at a certain volume and whatnot and the music playing and all that. You've heard me complain about this. I'm not going to back down on this one. Fries can be too salty. Going back to Mineta days, there's so much. You ever watch chefs like you like salt fries? You got your little metal bowl and you're tossing the fries in there, and it's just like handful after handful of salt. I'm like, why are you putting that much salt on your French fries?
Two healthy pinches.
It burns your lips.
Wait a second.
It's numbing.
Chefs like us. So you experience this everywhere, or just?
I've been at numerous restaurants.
At numerous places. So it might not be just a sensitivity to salt.
No, it's not. I love salt. I'm just saying it's an insensitivity that line cooks have to salt because they salt everything so much, and then they don't they don't taste it, or if they do taste it, they've been eating salt all night, and it's just like, guys, just like go a little easier on the salt.
So you're one of those one percenters that feel that our fries are oversalted.
Now, other people, I'm one of the persons who actually appreciates the details. And most people don't, and they just eat whatever they're given.
Oh, I see.
And it's like, I want my fries salted. I just don't want my fries over-salted.
For the viewers at home, when the order comes in, and you know, it's Adam's order, it's please, no extra salt on the fries.
I say fries.
And please
fries,
wipe the bowl before you toss the fries.
Lightly salted. That's all I said.
And wipe
lightly
the bowl.
I never said wipe the bowl. That's not true.
That has been a modifier on a ticket.
Someone else said that. I appreciate that. Lightly salt the bowl. Another thing I love, one more thing about your restaurant, love the wine list. Your wine guy, Jorge, what you brought over from Wild Air and Contra. All natural wine list. At what point did you decide to go in that direction? Because what I really appreciate about it is, and I wrote about this also, you have this very sort of rich, modern take on traditional French food, but the wine is very zippy and bright and light, and it doesn't knock you out and kind of put you on your ass. At what point did you say, you know what, we're going to go with an all natural list?
Pretty early on. I mean, as soon as we started concepting the restaurant, we were definitely. That's what we drink. So that's what we wanted.
We knew Jorge was going to be our guy. We knew it was going to be natural wine, and you know, part of concepting, and we talk about it. We didn't really concept either. We followed our instincts, followed our guts, and followed the way we like to eat and the way and what we would want in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't this, like, you know, this big vision board of things. And we were very conscious early on to sort of not retread, you know.
Yeah. However, what you want to drink, but you guys have some big ticket diners / clients / supporters who have eaten your food over the years. That's not what they want to drink.
Well, we'd hope that they would trust us and come along for the ride and experience something a little differently. I think, you know,
you do have certain people who want to, like, bring their own wine or something.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
If that's what you want to do, sure.
We don't allow a corkage fee. Actually, we don't do a corkage fee.
Really?
Yeah.
So who was that guy? There was that time, I was there one time, and the next table over was Serena Williams and her husband with this couple, and the guy was getting up. First of all, he was walking to the server station to grab his own bottle of Perrier because he didn't want to drink the salty Catalan water that you guys serve. And he was serving that. And then I think he had his own wine also.
Who does stuff like that?
I don't
Seriously.
Know. This big money guy who is...
Exactly. Exactly. It's not...
He brought
his own
water.
It's so absurd to us. And it's just made us dig in a little bit more. And it's not to be inhospitable.
Yeah.
Okay? But, you know, there's a reason for... You know, it's kind of thought out.
That's why I want less salt in my fries, because the water is so salty.
Well, we could have the other water.
What is the salty water called again?
Vichy Catalan.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's the natural wine of water.
The natural wine of water. All right, so Frenchette opened up there on West Broadway in Tribeca. You've made it a year and a half?
A year and a month.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
You guys are still together.
Yeah.
Mazel tov on that. We're going to ask you some quick lightning round questions.
Oh, boy.
Either or. You got to answer them. Either one you guys can answer. I didn't even know we even said who's who, by the way.
That's good.
You're Riyadh.
We're one person.
Yeah,
he's Riyadh. We're an organism.
Riyadh.
Bar seat or banquette?
As far as what we prefer?
Yeah. If you're going to French.
Lightning round.
Yeah.
Banquette. Yeah. I mean, I like both, but if I have to choose, then I would take banquette.
Ascot or pocket square?
I'm an ascot guy.
How many ascots do you own?
Well, I don't, but I like a handkerchief around my neck.
So you just take the same handkerchief and put it around your neck instead of in your pocket.
Yeah, and I usually blow my nose in it and then put it around my head when I'm on the line.
Riyadh or pate?
Pate.
Riyadh.
Do you have a favorite kind of Riyadh?
No, Riyadh. Yeah, duck or pork is fine. Yeah, Riyadh.
Pet nat or champagne?
Pet nat.
Mm, wow, made the leap.
Yeah, wow, it's awesome.
Really?
Yeah, I go both ways. No, I'll go natural grow or champagne.
Natural grow and compromise. All right, there you go. Steak or frites?
Steak frites, they go together.
No, you get one.
With less salt.
You get one.
It's a journey.
Frites.
Yeah, it ultimately becomes the frites and the steak sauce, the drippings.
I like steak. Track or casino?
Yeah.
Casino.
I used to like the track and I experienced something. You know, I saw a horse, you know, break its leg, rounding.
Ooh.
Yeah, and this was at Breeders' Cup, and that has just taken me. I'm off of horse racing 100%. Although I do kind of keep an eye on it a little bit from afar. So I'll say casino.
Misfits or Metallica?
Misfits.
Wow. Glad you guys are on the same page.
Yeah.
Gougère or Bellini?
Gougère.
Yeah, I like Bellinis. And caviar.
Bellinis and caviar. You're a fancy guy. You got the champagne. There's fancy Riyadh. It's so like funny. Everyman Lee over here.
I like it, yeah.
Goatee or ponytail?
Oh, that's easy.
Goatee. I mean, I have no choice.
Yeah. You have no choice. Do you remember Lee when he had hair?
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't much to remember either.
It was awesome.
Noma or Bocuse?
Bocuse.
Yeah. Bocuse. Yeah. Keep it at old school. Slap shot or wrist shot?
Oh, man. Nobody just rears back and, like, blasts one anymore.
Did you ever play hockey when you were a kid?
Yeah, sure. That's that was we played hockey together for a little while.
Yeah. Where?
Chelsea
Piers?
Yeah, yeah.
We had a team at Balzar. Well, it was in the Balzar team, but we had a few restaurant folks who were on our team.
Who got in more fights?
He's a hothead.
He's hot, yeah.
Yeah.
I usually have to break it up.
Man, there wasn't. And there's some shoving occasionally, you know. So.
Yeah. Wellfeet or Bellon?
Bellon.
Yeah, but well,
they're too big for me.
Yeah,
I can't deal with those.
You don't. You don't like
it? It's a lot of oyster.
Too briny for you.
I don't mind the brininess. Where you know where I was? I was at that Le Baron Rouge in Paris, that old school oyster bar. With the oysters from the north, it was shocking how briny they were compared to American oysters. Yeah. Just like the natural saltiness of them. I was like, holy cow.
The metallic. And,
you really tasted
it's like a battery.
Couple more before we let you go. Roast chicken for two or Côte de Bœuf for two?
Man, this is a tough question. So there's a time and place for both. I mean, I love a Côte de Bœuf, but the roast chicken with mashed potatoes is pretty, is the ultimate in comfort.
You guys do it, cut it up. Do you have like a plank of baguette with like sort of chicken liver smeared on it, or what's on the baguette?
Garlic butter. Well, it's like
garlic butter.
Drippings and garlic butter.
So it's all that funkiness is just the drippings.
Yeah, we just like soak it. It's almost like a French toast type of thing with
roast chicken, French toast.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask this last question, even though I feel like I don't need to, but we always do. Butter or olive oil?
Come on. That's easy. Yeah, it's butter.
Butter,
100%.
Riyad Nasser, Lee Hansen, thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.